All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show for you today, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be hearing from the LA Revolution Club about a recent arrest they faced down at the Criminal Courts Building. And before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network about the trials of the cops that killed Freddie Gray a little bit more than a year ago in Baltimore. And opening the show up, we have a very special segment. Over the last couple of weeks, there's been just a tremendous amount of attention focused on one of the most horrendous cases of rape and assault on women that has been publicly out there in a big way for quite some time. And it's the Stanford rape case. We're going to talk today with Sansara Taylor, who is a writer for Revolution, RevCom.us, and she's an advocate of Bob Avakian and his new synthesis of communism. And she is also the founder of StopPatriarchy.org. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, good to talk with you again. You know, in this situation, especially in this situation, because on the one hand, you're, you know, anybody with any kind of mind or heart, and especially anybody who's looking at the horrors that are going on in the world and looking at the horrors particularly committed against women all over the world, you see this thing in Stanford, this Stanford rape case, and your brain starts boiling from the beginning all the way through the thing. And you've talked about and written about this in a Revolution newspaper on RevCom.us, and you've talked about this horrendous case, and you say that this case is an X-ray of the whole culture of promoting and excusing violence and degradation against women. You also go on to say it's a concentration of the urgent need for the most radical and thoroughgoing revolution in the history of humanity. I want to talk about that in general right now, and we'll come back to that last point in particular, but let's talk about this, starting with this thing about it being an X-ray of the whole culture.
Yeah. Well, I think what we see here is there's a young woman who her evening began last January. She was hanging out with family, visiting home, just having a, you know, lighthearted evening, and made a last-minute decision to go to a party with her younger sister. And you think about how innocent and how joyful an act it should be to go accompany your sister, you're visiting, you go to a party. And she woke up the next morning from being blackout drunk in a hospital bed, being rolled around on a gurney, being told that she had been sexually assaulted and raped, and she had no recollection of it. She can't find her underwear. She says, you know, everything in her went silent when she started to realize what had actually happened. And honestly, millions and millions of women have been raped. Millions of women have gone through this in this country and around the world, on the college campuses, in the U.S. military, in the neighborhoods, in detention centers, in prisons. It happens to women every day. And what was so extraordinary about this case, honestly, is the courage and the voice of this young woman who really battled despair. And she wrote what became a public letter. It was at the time it was written just to the court, detailing what she had been through. And she battled the overwhelming feelings of despair and depression and isolation that come from this kind of sexual assault, and the kind of reassault that happens inside the courtroom when she was pummeled with questions, which happens over and over again to women who are victims of rape. What were you wearing? Why were you drinking so much? Who were you with? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? How many sexual partners have you had? What about this sexually suggestive message you left your boyfriend earlier that night as a voicemail? And, you know, she spoke out against this. And even in the face of that, and I hope that we'll talk more about what she had to say, the judge looked at this case, ignored the fact that the rapist expressed zero remorse and that the jury found him guilty on three felonies, said, you know, I think jail would have an adverse effect on this young man. I'd like to give him a light sentence, and gave him only 6 months in jail, which very likely might end up just being 3 months in jail and probation. And so it really was from the courts, from the media, from the way that this was treated, which is typical, the rapist was humanized, the rape was belittled, and the woman's suffering, the pain, the trauma, it was rendered not that big a deal in the eyes of the law.
You know, it's very heavy, because I was telling somebody, it was sort of like, basically what this rapist got was, in addition to all the treatment that he was given, all the avenues he was given to sort of even recast his whole story from the time the rape happened and what he was saying then to when he gets into court and what he's saying at that point, you know, and the whole way that this is, as you're saying, that step by step, it constantly was hitting at and pointing the finger back and pointing at, You know, the woman became the target on every front. She was the target of the rapist, and she was the target of the courts and the system in terms of, this is just something that you should have known better. And I kept thinking about, in relation to this, what she has gone through. And I think her letter really was just so powerful in terms of the way that it depicted what women go through in relation to this. And it wasn't sort of just crying, which is, there would be more than enough reason for her to cry and to be devastated. But she really stood up to this whole thing. And I thought it was really very, very important because, you know, look, you're looking at this rapist who gets basically what Otis the town drunk would get for a Saturday night, being too drunk and going out and screwing up a few telephone poles or something. He got nothing, nothing at all. And this woman, it really is not an exaggeration to say that her life, her whole entire life and her whole, you know, not to get all gauzy about it, but her whole life was put on review and inspection for everyone in this society. And she, you know, to the extent that she was ever even able to say anything, it was only because she came up with this statement that was really cast things. And it turned the court, it turned the whole scenario there into a whole different game.
Well, yeah, I think it's important. And I think people need to go to revcom.us and read her letter. If you have not read her letter, you need to read her letter, because she brings alive in very vivid, very, I mean, courageous and honest terms, the fact that the damage of rape does not end with the end of the physical act. It unfolds over a woman's lifetime. It revisits you, the invasion, the violation, the sense of worthlessness, the disrespect to your humanity that you have to live through. That revisits a woman over her lifetime. And it ripples out, it radiates out, and it affects and it damages the lives of everybody who cares about her. She describes the pain of having to tell her parents, of having to hold and comfort her younger sister, who feels tremendous guilt for inviting her to this party. Of course, her sister did nothing wrong. She describes having to tell her boss and the people around her, her boyfriend, and the pain that this causes. This shattered a family. It shattered a young woman. It shattered her family. And then rape hangs in the air as an active violation of every woman, because every woman gets the message every time, this could be you. And I think it's very important that she spoke and she gave voice to this, and that people confront this. We will never end rape. First of all, we'll never end it under this system. And I want to talk about that. We'll get to that. But we will never end rape without people, including men, confronting what it means to a woman to be raped. And you learn that by reading this letter. And I think, you know, in the end, she even says, look, I am one with all these women around the world who've been through the same thing. Hopefully my voice and my courage in speaking out will give you the strength and the courage to do the same. And she's right. And many more people need to speak up the way she's spoken up. Many more people need to intervene against this rape culture the way she did. But I also think we need to confront that after she read this letter, and it's incredibly powerful, after she read this letter that brought alive the pain and the anguish that rape caused her and everybody around her and women everywhere, and after she read this letter that took on every feeble, lame, entitled excuse that was made by Brock Turner, the rapist, that was made by his father, that was made by the parole officer, and she goes through, no, what I'm wearing has nothing to do and excuses nothing about the rape. You know, no. How much I drank is irrelevant. I shouldn't have been asked that on the stand by the lawyer. No, all of these questions, she takes on everything that was hurled at her. Brock Turner, the rapist, says, well, you know, he apologized for drinking. He says, oh, the culture of heavy drinking and promiscuity on campus. I want to educate people about the harm this can do. I've learned my lesson. She says, no, the problem wasn't drinking. The problem wasn't promiscuity. Promiscuity is when people voluntarily, willingly sleep with many people. Rape is when you do it against somebody's will. There's nothing in common. She demolished these excuses, these rationalizations that were made by the lawyer, by the parole officer, by Brock Turner, by his father, who said, oh, jail is a steep price for my son for 20 minutes of action. He called this vicious rape, 20 minutes of action. So the victim, she takes on every single one of these arguments, and after that, the judge gives a light sentence. And so really it was an act of censure. It was an act of openly dismissing the cogent, powerful, truthful, and courageous argument she made. And in that, this is where the x-ray comes in, because I think we have to face this too. This is not the exception. The only thing exceptional is that she wrote this letter and it got published and it went viral, so people heard about it. And that is really important. But the fact that the rapist got a light sentence, that is so unexceptional. I mean, we should think about the fact that Stanford, one of the most elite universities in the country, in the world, has never expelled a single person for rape before Brock Turner. We should think about the fact that thousands and thousands of rape kits sit unprocessed for years in police precincts all across this country. You should think about the fact that less than 2% of people who report rapes to police ever see their rapist go to jail. And 60, 70% of rapes aren't even reported to police. So the percentage of people who go to jail for violating a woman, for raping her, is minuscule. In this country, it was legal up until the 1970s to rape your wife in every single state in this country. And it was only in the 90s that it became illegal in every single state in this country. You know, a woman in the military is 12 times more likely to be retaliated against if she reports a rape than to see her rapist convicted. So this is not exceptional. This is the way this society functions. It is formally against the law to rape a woman, but for all intents and purposes, it is a protected activity. It's protected by the elite universities. It's protected by the military. It's protected by the courts. It's protected by the legal system. And then it's excused and belittled in the culture every day.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. She is also the founder of StopPatriarchy.org and an advocate for Bob Avakian and his new synthesis of communism. And we're talking about the outrageous Stanford rape case. As you're talking, I kept thinking about this thing, too, in terms of the stand that this woman took. I mean, here's this young woman who, again, everything is out there about what happened to her, and she's watching this unfold. And it's, you know, you can see both anger, but also, you know, just the horror of watching this unfold like this. And yet, as she's saying to this guy, when she hears his statement and to the judge and what he's doing and all this, and she keeps saying this thing about, look, as you're saying, it's not that you drank. It's not that you did too much of this. It's not that you didn't do this, or it's not any of this. But it's that you're not admitting that this is what you've done to me, that this is an assault on my very being, on the being of all women in society, and frankly, on all of society, if you look at it in a broader sense in terms of what it says about what's being reinforced in the society by what this guy is doing and saying, what he's done and said, and what they're doing in the courts. And she made this point, which I thought was very interesting, because there isn't, in her statement, it's such a powerful statement about her pain, her suffering, but also the broadness of her outlook in terms of this problem and what needs to be done. She even says that, and it's true, you mentioned this in your piece too, that she didn't have an ounce of revenge going in on this. She wasn't looking to, like, you know, let's just get in there and string this guy up. But she said, I might not have even objected to a lighter sentence than 14 or 15 years if this guy had a damn clue about what the hell he had done and why it is so wrong. And it was still, that was just sort of shunted aside. There was nothing there in the courts that actually even recognized what she was saying around that. It was sort of, this is sort of, yeah, it was the good old boy just patting down, boys will be boys, you know, or like Warren Zevon once said, he was just an excitable boy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there's a lot to learn. And again, this is a reason to read her letter. And I think people should read it in classrooms. I think people should read it in locker rooms. They should read it on sports teams. Church groups should read it. People should read it out loud, and they should read it together. I think it would serve a great purpose if people actually went through what she's written. And I think one of the, precisely what you're highlighting, the lack of revenge. She's not saying, look, I want to make you suffer like I suffered. She's saying, I want people to recognize what this does to a woman so that it never happens again. And that's an attitude that is really important. Now, I think for it to never happen again, we need to actually change. We need to get rid of the whole state that enforces this, the whole culture that cultivates men to feel entitled to this, to make them feel as Brock Turner did, because he's a product of this culture. He's not some anomaly. I wish he was, but he's not. That makes him feel like, or his father feel like, this could be described as 20 minutes of action. So this needs to be taken on. And I think that one other dimension I just wanted to mention is that it's also, there's been a lot of righteous anger at Aaron Persky, the judge who gave this light sentence. And there's been a lot of appropriate exposure of the fact that he, too, was a sports star, or at least an athlete at Stanford. He was an athlete, just like the rapist was at the same university. And people are right to be outraged with him, and they're right to say he has forfeited any right to sit in judgment over anybody else's life based on this sentence. He has no legitimacy. But I think we have to, again, recognize that even as we raise our voices against him, and we should, that this is part and parcel, this is intrinsic to U.S. American capitalist society. Rape serves a function. Rape serves a huge function. It is a way of terrorizing women all women, whether you've been raped yourself or not, the existence and pervasiveness of rape in this society and the amount to which it is green-lighted, excused, wink-wink illegal, but not actually enforced. This is a form of terrorizing all women to stay in their place, to know that, yeah, you could speak out a little, you might be able to get this job or that job, you might be able to do things that women in the past haven't been able to do, but you are still lesser, you are still lower, you are still constantly in threat of violence of your most core being by every man. Not that every man wants to rape, but this is what's being enforced, the privileges of all men over women through the excusing of rape. So it keeps women terrorized and subordinated, and at the same time, it is a form of protecting and enforcing the privileges of all men in this society. The rights and the privileges that go along with being male, even the privileges that are afforded to men who themselves find rape distasteful. You live in a culture where men have tremendous privilege and domination that's just afforded to you, and rape enforces this. We're going through a time when actually, at the same time that there's women's studies classes and many more women who assert themselves and many more women in the workforce and in elite universities, on the opposite side, there is a growing sense of rage and resentment of frustrated male entitlement that is lashing back. And this we see happening and intensifying. We see it in the Trump campaign. We see it in the violent degradation that's mainstream in pornography, the rape porn that is so common that so many kids are socialized and boys are socialized with, torture porn, the notion that women are objects to be dehumanized, tortured, played with for sexual arousal. These are very mainstream ideas, and they're escalating. This whole culture of violent revenge against women is growing. It's directly in proportion to women's advance into many realms that used to be all male bastions. It's a reaction against it. And this is growing at a time because so many men, including very oppressed men, are finding themselves increasingly economically unstable. They're losing their jobs and economic security. There's all kinds of social upheaval. There's the breakdown of the traditional family, and a lot of the traditional perks and privileges that used to go to fathers are no longer there in the same way. And so there's a simmering rage and revenge among those men, too, that's being fostered. And so we see this across the board. It's a very dangerous thing. And rape serves to enforce and protect those privileges.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. She is also the founder of StopPatriarchy.org and an advocate for Bob Avakian and his new synthesis of communism. And we're talking about the outrageous Stanford rape case. Okay, it's one thing. Yes, it serves a major function. Actually, what is that function? What is it that it serves? Could you get into it a little bit more, this thing about serving to reinforce and protect these privileges?
Yeah, I think people think, wow, and we're told women are making progress in this society. Oh, yes, this still goes on, but everybody knows it's wrong and it's being fought against. Actually, a lot of people know it's wrong, and many people are fighting against it, and it's very important, and many more need to. So that's very important, and I want to salute the two Swedish graduate students who were riding their bicycles past the party and saw this woman unconscious being raped behind a dumpster, and they didn't just say something. They physically got off, and when the guy ran away, they chased him and tackled him so that he couldn't get away. I want to salute them. We need many more people who put themselves on the line to stop this kind of violence and aggression towards women. So I think it's very important, one, to uphold that. But then you're asking, what role, what function does rape play? And I think that it's part of the glue of a patriarchal capitalist society. It's part of knitting the culture together. The patriarchal family is a core of the economic unit. Revenge against women is one of the big pillars, ideological pillars of the U.S. military. The domination of women by men is a major pillar of religious fundamentalism of every kind, including Christian fundamentalism, which is huge in this country. So I think rape, you look at the Bible, rape is one of the rewards that God's chosen people get to carry out when they win their wars against God's unchosen people. I mean, this is in the biblical text. Rape has been a cohering force of male supremacy. And we live in a male supremacist society. That's a big cornerstone of capitalism. And so that's part of why it's being excused. We're being told that the society is advancing, things are going forward for women. Yeah, there are a few remaining problems, but things are getting better. No, you look at the reality, rape is pervasive. Rape is pervasive, and it's pervasive. The courts let men off all the time. and it's pervasive that the women get demonized and shamed all the time and isolated and told, why are you making such a big deal about it? Why are you ruining this guy's prospects of playing sports on the team? You know, rather than saying, look at the lifelong shattering impact that rape has on a young woman or a woman of any age. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to confront how central it is. It's not an anomaly, and it's not just men. I know I spoke out, men get privileges from this, but it's not just men in some kind of essential way, or men in their human nature, or men, you know, that the problem is men. The problem is the way men are conditioned under a patriarchal capitalist system, and to the degree that men go along with it and reinforce that system, that's a huge problem.
All right, and that brings us to exactly to the point I really wanted to get to through this whole thing, which is you talk about from the very beginning of your piece, and when we started talking about this, you talk about how, yes, rape needs to be ended, and this, if you're serious about this, this means revolution, and in particular, communist revolution. Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, years ago, Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, made the point. He had read a statistic that said one in every four women in this society will be raped in her life. And he said that at the time that he read the statistic, it was estimating that the number would increase to one in three. And he said, right there, if there was nothing else wrong with this society and culture, including, you know, everything up to World War and the horrors and the torture that this society and this culture and this country has inflicted on the world and been part of, or the system of capitalism and imperialism has been part of, so if there was nothing else wrong, this statistic of how many women will be raped is reason enough alone to make a revolution, to wipe this system off the face of the planet and bring something radically new into being. And he's right. And I think this has been far too long that people have sat back and accepted, well, that the terms of discussion have been, at their best, how do we help women who've been victims of rape? I mean, that's an important discussion to have. How do we get justice for women who are raped? But at its best, we need a discussion about how do we end a world of the domination of women and sexual violence against women? How do we make it so that rape is a thing of the past? And that is going to take a revolution. It is going to take ripping up the whole economic and foundation of capitalism that has patriarchy and male domination woven into it, into its economy, into its culture, into its laws, into its ideology, into everything about the way that people are socialized and trained to think in this society. You need a total revolution. You need a communist revolution. And one of the things that Bob Avakian has done as a key dimension, one of the key dimensions of his whole new synthesis of revolution and communism, is to really grasp how central the fight to break the chains on women is, to the fight to put an end to all traditional property relations, all traditional social relations, that we really have to unleash the fury of women and the impatience of women as a mighty force for revolution. Women today speaking up, speaking out against the violence that's done to them, raising their voices, refusing to be silent, like this young woman refused to be silent, refusing to be broken by what's done to you, but instead coming out and expressing your anger and making people see it and demanding an end to a system that does this and perpetuates this. This needs to be a big thing now, and it needs to be a thing even after the revolution. When we have revolutionary state power, some things are going to change right away. It will not just be technically against the law to rape women. It actually will be something that gets prosecuted and punished. And women will not be asked what they were wearing. They will not be asked who they've slept with in the past. They will not be asked that in the courtroom. They will not be asked that by the police when they call the police for help. They will not be asked that in the media. That will stop. There are things that can be stopped right away when we have state power with a genuine communist revolution. And then there can be real education, real sex education, age-appropriate sex education for kids in the school that talk about mutual respect, that talk about women's bodies and reproduction, so to demystify that, but also about pleasure, about mutual respect, about equality, and about the importance of consent in sexual relations. Those things will change right away. We will teach that. But then there are other things that are going to take more time, and one of the things that Avakian has really fought for is a recognition of the fact that repeatedly there'll be a question posed, you know, will we continue to dig up the vestiges of male supremacy in people's thinking, in the family, in the culture, in the sexual relations between people? Will we continue to dig up all the oppression and inequality, or will we settle in and let those things retrench? And if we don't keep fighting to dig them up completely, the very notion of what it means to be a man, to be dominant, to be aggressive, to be callous, those notions, if we don't keep digging those up, a recognition that that they'll reassert themselves, they'll grow, and they will actually be a big part of dragging society back, not just back towards patriarchy, but back towards the whole setup of capitalism with all its exploitation, all its unjust wars, all of its white supremacy, that the oppression of women is that central. It's not the only thing we have to fight to uproot, but it is a big central, and it's a driving force for revolution, both in making the revolution now and in continuing to transform society after the seizure of power. And so this is a really important thing, and it's gone into in the Constitution for the new Socialist Republic of North America that Bob Avakian wrote, and that you can find at revcom.us. And it's gone into in a very powerful compendium from him called Break All the Chains, Bob Avakian on the Liberation of Women and the Communist Revolution. This is the most radical approach to both emancipating humanity, but also liberating women as a key and driving force in that.
All right, Sansara Taylor, thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm really glad to be with you, Michael. I just want to say one last thing, and that is that right now, people have to reject the whole rape culture, and they have to start living a different way. And I want to read the letter from this young woman, mm-hmm. read it out loud, find it at revcom.us, and go and find the principles from the Revolution Club that are posted in a proclamation that was issued from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party that talk about really living a different morality and principles today. Women as our sisters and comrades who hold the potential to be equal partners in remaking the whole world, but not if we treat them like property. And so this is a very essential thing. People should join in raising their voices, in speaking out, in intervening in sexual violence, but also sexual harassment. Speak up, raise your voice, and don't let this go on.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly where I was hoping you would go after I started to say that. So let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and revcom.us. She is also the founder of stoppatriarchy.org and an advocate for Bob Avakian and his new synthesis of communism. And we're talking about the outrageous Stanford rape case. You know, when you're talking about the cultural assault that all this represents, and I was thinking about, in particular, because it does concentrate not the same questions, but similar questions, the attack, the murderous assault on a gay club in Orlando by someone who apparently was just so enraged about people who, men loving men, women loving women, and just felt that culturally, ethically, morally, he had to go in and destroy this. It seems like the same kind of mindset to a certain extent.
It is. It is. I mean, look, this is a country that is steeped in anti-gay bigotry, grotesque notions of manhood in opposition to women and in opposition to human beings who love in ways that don't conform to traditional patriarchal notions, or who express their gender in ways that don't conform to traditional binary patriarchal notions of manhood and femaleness. All this really is of a piece with patriarchy, which is at the foundation of and woven into capitalism. And it's something that has to be resisted. It's a horrible act of terror against gay, trans, bi people across this country and around the world that this happened. I mean, it's especially vicious that this happened to people. It seemed mainly Black and Latino people in a club on Latin night. It was an act of vicious hatred. And it's something that nobody should tolerate. But at the same time, nobody should allow this country, this system of American imperialism, to pimp off our genuine horror and pain at this, to use that to demonize people who have already been demonized, Muslims and immigrants and people around the world. We have to stand against all of this. You know, we have to stand up against American imperialism with all of its strains of hypermasculinity, patriarchy, and bigotry, anti-gay bigotry, which are as American as apple pie, and against any kind of fundamentalism, including Islamic fundamentalism, which are equally horrific, even if enacted on a smaller scale. We need a different way. And so this is what Bob Avakian has brought forward. This is what the revolution clubs are fighting to make real. And this is what people can find at revcom.us. And you need to be part of bringing forward the solution.
All right, Sansara, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. All right, once again, that was Sansara Taylor. And as I said earlier, Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. She is also the founder of StopPatriarchy.org, and she is an advocate for Bob Avakian and his new synthesis of communism. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
He took little Susie to the junior prom. Excitable boy. They all said,
excitable boy.
And he raped her and killed her. Then he took her home. Excitable boy, they all said,
excitable boy.
Well, he's just an excitable boy.
All right, welcome back. That was Warren Zevon with Excitable Boy. And I just couldn't stop myself from playing that song because it was so pertinent to what we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor about. Joining us now is Carl Dix. Carl Dix is a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the founder, along with Cornel West, of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking with Carl today about the murder trials of the cops indicted for the murder of Freddie Gray. Now, actually, Cesar Goodson, the Baltimore cop who subjected Freddie Gray to a rough ride, as they call it, over a year ago that resulted in Freddie's death, is on trial for murder. His trial is the third of the trials of the police involved in the murder of Freddie Gray. The first two trials ended without convictions. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, Carl, I was really looking forward to having you on this time because, not that I don't look forward to having you on all the time, but in particular this time because there is just so damn much going on in relation to Baltimore. It seems to concentrate a lot of horror in the world today. You know, you were there when in the aftermath of Freddie Gray being killed. You know, you come from Baltimore, you know the history of the city, you know what's been going on for a long time. What the hell is happening with this Goodson trial?
Well, I look at this Goodson trial as an injustice on top of an injustice on top of an injustice. The foundational injustice was the modern-day lynching of Freddie Gray. The police chasing him, beating him down, torturing him, arresting him for nothing, throwing him in the van, bent up like a pretzel, not listening to him when he cried out for medical assistance, then giving him the rough ride and killing him, basically. That was the first injustice. Because people stood up, because people rebelled, the authorities stepped back and felt like, okay, we got to indict these guys. But then the trial becomes a second injustice because the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. And you see that every day in court as the prosecution is putting on its case. It's bringing on witnesses who are making the arguments for the defense. You know, they put on a guy who was supposed to talk about the rough ride that Officer Goodson had given to Freddie Gray. The guy gets up on the stand and said he saw no evidence that Goodson had given him a rough ride. And this was a prosecution witness. So that's the second injustice. And it also includes, like, one thing that has not been brought into court is there's been no testimony of the beatdown and the torture that Gray received before he was put in the van. That's been totally outside the case, even though there's a video of it. Millions of people have seen it. It hasn't made it into the case. But then the third injustice is the way in which they have gone to extra limits to try to grease the skids to have this killer cop walk. Because today, the lead investigator for the prosecution testified, but not for the prosecution. He testified for the defense and testified against the case that he was supposedly the lead investigator for. And what this reflects is infighting within the police department and between the police department and the district attorney. And it is really setting things up to let this cop walk because the lead investigator argued that what happened to Freddie Gray was an accident that his spine was nearly severed and he died. And he said that the medical examiner had told him that she felt it was a freakish accident as well, even though she denied it. And he was allowed to come into court on a ruling that came from notes of a conversation that he had given, which the judge said, well, normally this would be hearsay, but I'm going to penalize the prosecution for violating discovery, and I'm going to admit this hearsay. And that opens the door to this guy to come in and testify for the defense. So it is really new lows from what I can see. And I've seen, and I was not surprised with the prosecutors not really coming in and fighting to convict these cops. But this was a new twist for me. I was not expecting the lead investigator for the prosecution to just come in and testify for the defense. So this is what's going on. And where it is aimed at is what we see again and again in these cases of police brutalizing and murdering people. And that is getting the cops off. It's like Bob Avakian has said, yes, there is a conspiracy to get the cops off. And it's right out in front of your face. And that's what's going down right now in Baltimore.
Well, you look at this thing, and Caesar Goodson, I mean, he's the cop now that they've charged with murder. And the way that the trial is going, you know, it's like you're saying, it's like these kids are being greased, but for what it seems to be shaping up is sort of another acquittal, you know, and who knows whether that's going to happen or not happen, but they're certainly putting a lot of effort into that. And the first two cops that went on trial were not convicted of anything. I mean, one got, what was it, a bench acquittal or something like that, and the other one got a mistrial or something, right?
A mistrial, yeah. That's exactly what happened.
Right, and you have six cops that have been charged for this. Now, you mentioned, you know, and it's almost like they're setting it up as a parade of people stepping into court to be whitewashed and set free again. And you talked about in relation to something you wrote. You said that in the old days, this would have been a racist white lynch mob doing a black man like this. Well, today it's the cops. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, see, that's why I started out by saying the first injustice was a modern day lynching, because it really is the case that the police departments all across the country have stepped in to the role that during slavery was played by the patrollers, paddy rollers, who saw to it that the slaves didn't escape from the plantation and kept them in line. Then the Klan and racist lynch mobs, you know, delivering a message of terror with a death sentence hanging over the head of every black person, one that may or may not have been carried out, but was always hanging there to remind you to keep in your place. Well, right now what we're dealing with is the police department's playing this role. And it really does come down to something else that Bob Avakian has said, and that is that the role of the police is not to protect and serve the people, but to protect and serve the system that rules over the people. And right now that role concentrates up around controlling and suppressing especially black and Latino people, and especially the youth, who this system has nothing for. You know, legitimate means of employment to survive and raise families have disappeared for millions of people in the inner city. The educational system has been geared to fail our youth. All they really have for young people are cops, courts, prisons, and early graves. And so they need to have the cops unleashed and ready to instill terror in these youth. And you would chill that if you started to convict cops for brutalizing and murdering people. So this is a horror that is built into the very way that this system functions, the way that it operates. And it's something that these authorities couldn't back away from if they wanted to, and they don't want to.
You know, you make a point in some of the, again, in some of the writings you've done, you made a point around where there's no question that Freddie Gray was actually alive and well before he ran into the cops that day. And so you're looking at this, and all the stuff that you're saying, it just keeps hitting me in the head, because all the stuff that you're saying is they're acting like, and actually the way it's presented is sort of like, look, Freddie Gray died because he died, okay? You know, and you look at when they're going not guilty, mistrial, not guilty, whatever, all these things, and all the stuff you were just describing about this trial, it does say something. And when you're linking, you know, something very, very horrendous about what's going on in relation to black people and in relation to, you know, people understanding the character of this society. And you've made a point often that, and you talk, and you refer to Avakian a lot around this, but the fact that it's not just, it's a statement from the system that black life does not matter, but it's a statement from this system. And that there's, that this is something that people have to actually understand, because it's not just a question of, you know, a lot of people are saying, why is it so hard to get a damn conviction here? Why it shouldn't be that hard? The man was walking happy and smiling until he got into the van. And then he never got out of the van as a whole human being again. And he's dead, and now nobody's paying anything for it. You know, and so you look at it, and I'd like you to tie that in a little bit more with, you know, what you've said about this is part of the character of the system. It's woven into the system.
Yeah. See, one thing I wanted to bring up, there's some of the talking heads that they're using in this case, you know, who comment on this, have said, a couple of them have said, made basically the same point, that you can't charge police for doing these things, because if you did, you'd have to charge the whole doggone police department. And what they're essentially commenting on is that this is standard operating procedure for police departments all across the country. This is what it comes down to. This is the role that they play. And look, that is something that people have to look straight in the face of. And for a lot of the oppressed, they have that feeling and they don't see any way out of it. And then for a lot of people in the middle classes and stuff like that who are relatively shielded from it, they only see the exceptional cases and get told that these are isolated incidences. But the reality is there to look at. You know, we're actually able to see a lot of it because a lot of it's getting videoed these days. And people have to look at exactly what's happening, and then they have to dig at why does this happen? Why does this happen again and again? And the reason for that is just what I was speaking about. This is built into the fabric of this system. This is a necessary part of the system continuing to function and to operate. And it just comes down to that unless and until there's a revolution, an actual revolution, one that overthrows this system and puts a totally different and far better system in its place, this horror, as well as all the other horrors that this system brings down on people here in this country and around the world, are going to continue. And that is why we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are organizing right now for that actual revolution at the soonest possible time.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Now, Carl, let me ask you this, because I think it's really important what you're saying. You're talking about how this is the system. It's part of the actual workings of the system. But there's something that you wrote where you actually, and I think it's important for people to understand this, because I was thinking, even as we're going through this whole thing of what's happening in Baltimore and other places around the country, that we're looking at something that's happening where there's, you know, you have the sort of the new broadcast of the new roots, and people get to begin to see a certain, God, this is really what it was like. You know, where all of the sort of nice veneer around, you know, well, slaves, yes, they had it hard, but really, you know, it wasn't as bad as everybody thinks. Or, you know, you have all of that, and you have Underground, which is another series that actually really pushed up and pushed out the conditions of black people historically in the society. And then you go all the way through that, and you follow it all the way up through, you know, to where black people were not considered a whole human beings by the official government rulings. And you're looking at all these things, and then you look at Emmett Till, and then you look at what happened to people since then. You know, let's talk about this in terms of the actual workings of this system that require an actual revolution in order to stop this and everything else.
Yeah, because when you actually look at it, at every point, a key foundational pillar of this system has been the systematic and vicious exploitation of black people. And that continued all the way up into a few decades ago. But then a development that began to develop and accelerate was the actual chase after profit of this capitalist system, meaning that they needed to find new areas to exploit workers that they could exploit even more viciously than they could workers on the bottom of the scale here in this country. And that has led to manufacturing being moved halfway around the world. People in Asia, people in South America, people in Mexico being paid far less, worked in much more dangerous conditions than people here had faced. And what it has meant here is millions and millions of people growing up in the inner cities who have no access to legitimate ways to survive and raise families. That's the reality that I was trying to speak to earlier. So that's what we're dealing with, and it really is a function of this globalized capitalist imperialist economy with the need to be lean and mean and chasing after, you know, the maximum profit that you can get, which means greater levels of exploitation of people around the world. And then you're left with all these people that you have nothing for, that you need a way to keep under control. And that's what we're dealing with today in terms of the continued unleashing of cops to brutalize and murder people, especially in the inner cities, and the terror that spreads. And it really is a necessary function that, and it becomes a very big problem when that gets broadly exposed, resistance is built to it, the way that's developed. But it's not a problem that they can then give in to. They have to continue to go with it. So, okay, you had a rebellion in Baltimore. You had the explosion of resistance to police murder all across the country. But even in the face of that, the brutality and the murder has continued, and also the exoneration of the brutalizers and the murderers. Because even where it is right out in the open that this has happened, whether that's been Michael Brown, Eric Garner in New York, Tamir Rice, cases where we've even seen the murder being carried out, it still gets carried out and the murderers still get exonerated. And that's what we're dealing with. And it is very important that people not say, okay, we protested this, we showed that we didn't like it, we even did powerful things like a rebellion in Baltimore, I guess that means we just have to take it. It's very important that people reject that approach, which is one that the authorities are trying to ingrain in people, because some of these developments in court got great publicity to try to create a mood among people to like, yeah, okay, you rose up, you made us indict these cops, but we're still going to let them go. And it's very important for people to step out and say no. And that's why I've joined with other activists here in Baltimore, people like Tawanda Jones, whose brother Tyrone West was murdered by the Baltimore police, Reverend David Olson, a Unitarian minister who's been active against injustice on a number of fronts here in Baltimore, a couple of other relatives of police murder victims whose names are escaping me right now. I'm going to have to apologize to a few people after I do this show. But anyway, we've called for people to be in the streets in response to this verdict, in the streets saying, we refuse to sit back and silently take you exonerating killer cop after killer cop, because it's going to be very important to give heart to people who are angered by this and want to know what, if anything, we can do. And doing this is also an important part of organizing people, mobilizing them to stand up, to fight the power, and transforming them for revolution. So it's a crucial part of what's really necessary to not only fight back against these attacks and not allow them to beat us down until we're completely broken, but it's also part of organizing the solution to this problem, and that's an actual revolution.
All right, Carl, we have about two more minutes left, 2.5 minutes left. Let me ask you this. You've mentioned actual revolution a couple of times here. It's necessary. People have to be talking about this if they want to talk about not just the, you know, emancipation of black people and stopping the suffering of black people, but the emancipation of all humanity all around the world, all of humanity all over. What is this actual revolution? Break it down for people a little bit. What exactly are you talking about, an actual revolution, and what will it do?
Well, what I'm talking about is a revolution that overthrows this system, that mobilizes, brings forward a revolutionary people numbering in the millions, that moves to act when the time is right, when the crisis of the system is deep enough to create an opening, and meets and defeats the attempts at violent suppression of the system and overthrows the system and brings a totally different and far better system, you know, into being, a socialist system that's in transition to a full classless communist world. And it will be a world where the horrors of today, the vicious attacks on women, the taking away from women their right to choose to have an abortion, drone missile strikes, wars for empire, the vicious oppression of black people, the way that our immigrant sisters and brothers are dogged and deported and disappeared by the system, all of that will have been ended, and people will be working in common for the common good and moving towards that being the way in which society works in a, when we reach the full classless communist society. I can't break all of this down, but let me point out two things that people can get connected with by going to the website revcom.us, revcom.us. One is a important message that the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party has issued, time to get organized for an actual revolution. It breaks some of this down, including getting into the leadership that we have for this revolution. In Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and what people need to do today, which includes going to that website that I just talked about, and also getting with the Revolution Club, a club that is organizing to fight the power and transform the people for revolution and spreading this message that things don't have to be this way, and through revolution we could bring a totally different and far better world into being. And it's also got principles to live, to fight, and to die for in terms of becoming the kind of people who will concentrate and exemplify the kind of system that we're fighting to bring into being.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about the trial of Caesar Goodson, the Baltimore cop who killed Freddie Gray during a rough ride over a year ago, okay, in Baltimore, Maryland. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, you'll be listening to some excerpts from a press conference held by the Los Angeles Area Revolution Club, so stay tuned.
He wasn't a loony with a son of gun, a dangerous terrorist on the run. He'd never been mugging or molested a nun, was really quite a regular guy.
All right, welcome back. That was Blue Murder by Tom Robinson. On Wednesday morning in Los Angeles, eight people from the Los Angeles Revolution Club were illegally arrested in front of the Los Angeles Criminal Courthouse. They were bringing the message from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The Revolutionary Communist Party is organizing now to overthrow this system at the soonest possible time, preparing to lead an actual revolution to bring about a radically new and better society, the new socialist republic in North America. As they set up and started speaking to people about their project, eight members of the Revolution Club were suddenly arrested, and those arrested were charged with a misdemeanor, picketing near a courthouse to obstruct justice. And this is a serious charge with the possibility of up to 180 days in jail if convicted. On Thursday, July 16th, the Los Angeles Area Revolution Club held a press conference in front of the criminal courts building, the same place where they were arrested the day before. And right now we're going to bring you some statements from that press conference.
My name is Lucha Bright, and I'm with the Los Angeles Revolution Club. Yesterday, eight of us with the Revolution Club were illegally arrested for bringing the message, it's time to get organized for an actual revolution, here to the criminal courthouse. This message goes on to say, the Revolutionary Communist Party is organizing now to overthrow this system at the soonest possible time, preparing to lead an actual revolution to bring about a radically new and better society, the new socialist republic in North America. We were here to connect this message with people whose rights are taken away every day in this criminal courthouse that is indeed criminal, grinding up black and brown people like a meat grinder as part of backing up a criminal system that provides no future for the youth. The people ground up by this courthouse have the right to be reached with this message. And we were prevented from our legal right to do so, to bring this to people, by the LA County sheriffs. The same sheriffs who carry out vicious and bloody brutality against people held in their jails and the people who visit them. Given how much injustice goes on in this building, there are protests and demonstrations here all the time. We were here marching in formation and reaching people with this message. We had every right to do so, and we broke no laws. It is this message itself that the authorities here found intolerable and decided to break their own laws to stop from being heard. We demand that all charges against the Revolution Club be dropped immediately. Finally, I want to tell you what the Revolution Club is about. As the message from the Revolutionary Communist Party says, the Revolution Club is where you get organized to fight the power today to stop the horrors of this system and to transform the people for revolution. Revolution requires a scientific approach. The Revolution Club is where you learn Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism and how to apply it to solve the challenges we face. The Revolution Club upholds, lives by, and fights for the following principles. One, we base ourselves on and strive to represent the highest interests of humanity, revolution and communism. We do not tolerate using the revolution for personal gain. Two, we fight for a world where all the chains are broken. Women, men, and differently gendered people are equals and comrades. We do not tolerate physically or verbally abusing women or treating them as sexual objects. Nor do we tolerate insults or jokes about people's gender or sexual orientation. Three, we fight for a world without borders and for equality among different peoples, cultures, and languages. We do not tolerate insults, jokes, or derogatory names about a person's race, nationality, or language. Four, we stand with the most oppressed and never lose sight of their potential to emancipate humanity, nor of our responsibility to lead them to do that. We work to win people of all backgrounds to take part in the revolution and do not tolerate revenge among the people. Five, we search for and fight for the truth, no matter how unpopular, even as we listen to and learn from the observations, insights, and criticisms of others. And finally, we are going for an actual overthrow of this system and a whole better way beyond the destructive, vicious conflicts of today between the people. Because we are serious, at this stage, we do not initiate violence, and we oppose all violence against the people and among the people. Again, we are the Revolution Club, and eight of us were illegally arrested yesterday for bringing the message it is time to get organized for an actual revolution. Here to the people, coming in and out of this courthouse and ground up by it every day. We demand the charge be dropped, as it is an illegal and unlawful arrest. Thank you.
And the Revolution Club has encouraged people to call the L.A. City Attorney to demand that the charges be dropped. And that number is 213-978-8100. All right, that brings us dangerously close to the end of yet another show. I want to thank everybody that worked on the show today. My engineer, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Alex Brenner, Jeff Pryor, and Matt Kwiklinski. And all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more from Tom Robinson and Blue Murder.